president conditioning security assistance on an investigation into his political opponent prior to this administration? Is this something we would do all the time?
No, sir.
Why not?
We condition assistance on issues that will improve our foreign policy, serve our foreign policy, ensure that taxpayers' money is well spent. Those are and those conditions are either coming from the Congress or from policy decisions stemming from authority Congress has given us to make sure that the taxpayers' money is well spent, or that the receiving country takes the actions in our national interest.
That was Congressman and failed Democratic presidential candidate Eric Swalwell questioning acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. To Ukraine, William Taylor, during last week's opening day of the long-awaited House of Representatives impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Sudeman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, gang.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We're going to talk about week one of impeachment and hopefully preview some of week two here in a bit. But first, what are you doing next July? I'm going to tell you what you're going to do, and that's go to Vegas for the terrific annual convention called Freedom Fest, where you can see a whole host of libertarian luminaries, including most of us on this very podcast. This year, the keynote speaker at Freedom Fest is, are you ready for this? The... My God! The electrically controversial Mr. Jordan Peterson, author of the mega bestseller 12 Rules for Life, who will be asking whether a cultural revolution is either pronounceable or it could happen here in North America. So go to freedomfest.com. The registration's open right now. Just 399 smackaroonies. Do it. All right. With no more fanfare from Nick Gillespie's mouth trumpet.
I was going to say, Matt, actually, just to prolong the fanfare, I think if you wait, how would it work with the rapidly depreciating dollar because of Federal Reserve policy? Does it make sense to buy now or wait until the last minute?
That's a very good question, but I think they'll just jack up rates on you. So it's above and beyond the yeah. degradation of the fiat currency that we all are tethered to. What? That's fine.
No, Freedom Fest is good fun, you know?
You're going to be hearing more about Freedom Fest all throughout the podcast. So let's see if we can talk about other things in the meantime. So after the years of waxy buildup, we finally got a House impeachment inquiry last week. I am playing for an audience of, like Jim Jordan, I'm playing for an audience of one. it began with Ambassador William Taylor and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, both of whom had sounded the alarm first privately and now publicly about President Trump's irregular campaign of apparent pressure on the new Ukrainian president to announce an investigation, at the very least, into activities involving the son-in-law of the then Vice President Joe Biden back in the day. Then on Friday of last week, and we're doing this on a Monday, obviously, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch, that's the last time I'm going to pronounce that name, talked about being yanked prematurely out of her job after what looks to have been a kind of smear campaign conducted by the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. This week, this is the preview now, from Tuesday to Thursday, we're going to hear from eight witnesses, or supposed to, most anticipatedly, Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, who seems to have been the point man on the aforementioned irregular channel diplomacy. He, if you might recall, changed his closed door testimony after new events came to light and says, well, actually, yes, he did tell the Ukrainian president that delivery of U.S. military aid was likely contingent on the Biden investigation announcement. So there's a lot to chew on. I'm going to start by setting the volleyball up near the net by Catherine Mangu-Ward's face Ward. Catherine, what did you learn?
First of all,
what?
That analogy is triggering me very badly. I did not do well in gym, in volleyball. So please choose another one or just proceed and we'll pretend it didn't happen.
What did you learn during the first week of impeachment?
What did I learn? I learned that the sort of live real-time process of messaging to the American public about what exactly Donald Trump did wrong, it seems to be going pretty well. So I was struck by the fact that we've been talking about quid pro quos for a few weeks now, kind of inside the Beltway, inside the close watchers of these proceedings. But Nancy Pelosi and others have switched to the word bribery. I think this is a sort of, from a strategic perspective, it's interesting because it's easier to understand. It's generally what people associate with political corruption. Oh, bribery in politics. It's weird, though, because it's not actually bribery. If anything, it's extortion. It's the other way around. I suppose maybe he was bribing them with the military aid, but it was a threat to withhold, so that's a little bit tricky. But I am interested in the use of these words because I do think they're meaningful. I think, you know, the watering down and the idea of this very sort of simple crime does seem to be convincing some people. There's been some sort of nervous twitches in the polling in the direction against Trump. Also, I will say I have struggled to...
There's an Ipsos poll that now shows that 70% of Americans believe that what Trump did with regards to Ukraine was wrong. Now, that's
right.
Not should be impeached, but 70%, that's like a very clear finding.
And again, the phrasing there is interesting, right? Like, because if you say, did he commit a quid pro quo? People don't know what that is. If you say, was there bribery or extortion? At least people can mentally translate that as just a thing that is bad, something that is wrong. And I think that might be moving.
Are you saying that
and bribery is in the Constitution?
And bribery is in the Constitution. So that is an extra bonus on that keyword.
Which is why they're using that word, even though it's not exact.
Yeah. There's a bribery split out there in libertarian land. Our friend Judge Andrew Napolitano has been talking up the possible bribery crime. Really, here being something that could be charged, whereas our even closer friend, Jacob Sullum, has been, I think, more skeptical. And as always with Jacob Sullum, very exact about his way of approaching that question. Suderman, what was your big takeaway besides the fact that Catherine apparently thinks that Americans are too stupid to understand Latin?
They are. This is not a Catherine apparently thinks. That's just a true thing.
I'm too stupid to understand Latin, so I'm
Alia
with Catherine on this one.
Est.
I think in a lot of ways what we learned was what has been pretty clear all along, which is that Trump, through his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and probably Mick Mulvaney, you know, the guy who said, yeah, we did a quid pro quo, ran a shadow foreign policy outside normal diplomatic channels in which the goal was to influence Ukraine, to make a public statement about investigating a political rival. You know, the short version of this is Trump used the levers of executive power for personal political gain. And then the second thing I think that sort of, I'm not even sure if it's something I learned, but something that became even more real to me is that Trump supporters appear willing to make practically any argument in order to defend him, except a substantive defense of what he actually did. And in particular, what kind of irked me and what I thought was notable were the self-described constitutional conservatives who were making really bad constitutional arguments, in particular with regards to the Sixth Amendment. So you have Rand Paul saying, you know, the Sixth Amendment, it's pretty clear. It's part of the Constitution, part of the Bill of Rights. And it says you get to confront your accusers. You have one of the co-founders of the Federalist Society also making a Sixth Amendment argument. You know, the impeachment is a legal proceeding, he said. Just as criminal defendants have a constitutional rights in criminal trials, so too does Trump have constitutional rights, which House Democrats are denying him. The thing is, the Sixth Amendment applies to criminal trials. This is not a criminal trial. This is a congressional proceeding. There was actually a very good post by the Cato Institute's David Post on the Volokh conspiracy, which is hosted by Reason.com, just sort of like breaking this down and making very clear that there is absolutely no reason to think that House Democrats, that the impeachment process so far is denying Trump his Sixth Amendment rights at all. But this is something that Rand Paul, that folks associated at a high level with the Federalist Society are saying in order to defend him. Meanwhile, the Republicans who are, you know, involved in the impeachment process just don't appear to have any substantive response to what Trump did. Everybody, we are now in that, and that, I mean, I think that sort of tells you why so many Americans, to go back to the polling numbers, appear to think this is wrong, is because there isn't really a great defense of this is okay, this was fine, all well and good.
Nick?
Yeah, but there are also, I mean, what I found, or what I walk away from, is that what this absolutely foregrounds is impeachment is a political process. It is not a legal proceeding, although it takes that form. And, you know, all of the things that we're talking about here, you know, we need more information. And I'm really interested to see what the specific articles of impeachment are. But it's not clear to me at all that anything Trump has done warrants removal from office. And is that different from what has preceded in other, you know, in other instances? There are times when, you know, presidents ask foreign governments, or the U.S. government asks foreign governments to help with investigations, you know, that are going on here or in foreign countries. To talk about Trump, you know, doing diplomacy outside of, you know, irregular channels, it's his prerogative as a chief executive. And this isn't to defend Trump, but I'm worried about, you
know,
the
concept.
Sort
of sounds like you're defending Trump.
Yeah, no. Well, what I'm saying is there's a process to say, oh, there is a regular diplomatic channels, and that is the only way diplomacy ever gets done, et cetera. That's buying into a one view of how diplomacy gets done.
But I don't think anyone's saying that, Nick.
No.
No.
Yeah, actually, I think people are. That's why you're saying this is somehow, the implication is always that anything that doesn't go through, you know, the ambassador in a particular place or whatever is, you know, is somehow illegitimate.
They actually went over
or through the State Department. I'm just saying
that's what
people are taking
about
away
this
from
last
this.
Week. We're talking about what the hearings taught us last week, and they went over this in some detail. And the witnesses said, yes, often there is other channel diplomacy.
Right.
It happens all the time. That's not the issue. The issue is
The way it is being represented is that
no,
why
it's not that's
yeah,
not how they answer the question.
Okay.
They answer the question being the thing that is irregular here is not the channel. It's what the channel was doing, which is exacting a political favor in the domestic American scene.
Is it all Trump has to do to
Rudy
I
Giuliani
think,
told the New
excuse
York
me,
Times
me,
in
let
May
me finish. Yeah,
that
let me
this
finish.
This was intended to personally benefit his private clients.
Yes. There was also in 2017, newspapers, places like Politico were awash with stories about how Ukraine forces in Ukraine, people in Ukraine, including people in the government, were trying to impact and influence the 2016 election. For Trump to say we want investigation of this, including Joe Biden, including Hunter Biden, I think that is an easy way to say my intentions were, and we have yet to hear from Trump testifying. Drudge right now has at the top that he's open to testifying. That's probably horseshit, et cetera. But Trump has to, basically what Trump has to say to get out of this, so far in what I've seen, is to say my intention was to investigate the ways in which Ukraine was trying to influence our election, and that led to Joe Biden. And I was doing it both, you know, if it hurts Joe Biden, it hurts Joe Biden, but it's also good for the country to know what Ukraine was up to. This is a political procedure. Judge Napolitano, who is very much in favor of impeaching Trump, and it seems to removing him from office, said most recently last week on Neil Cavuto that impeachment and impeachable offense is whatever a majority of Congress decides at a particular time. That's what this is about. And I think from a libertarian point of view, right now, the thing that worries me, to be honest, is that Congress is finally flexing, right? This, you know, feckless Congress that we've had for decades that won't even fucking say to the president, you need a declaration of war. You know, whenever that happens, is now saying, okay, because of this, we are going to move to remove the president. I think that's mostly political. This doesn't strike me as such a, you know, a gross abuse of power that we should be talking about removing the president, regardless of who the president is.
Catherine, is there not a tautology in what Nick says, though, in the sense that it's an act of government that's political, right? Like, how do you avoid the political in an adversarial process in Congress, particularly at our moment of kind of all up or all down polarization?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one thing that I was struck by is as I'm digging into this, as I'm, like everyone else, sort of learning about the intricacies of how this process works, both the impeachment process and, frankly, a lot about the diplomatic process, which I didn't know. There has been some, I think, underappreciated commentary about the fact that Congress does have an oversight role, even in this most discretionary of foreign policy and diplomatic conduct. So if the president had decided to withhold the aid for a legitimate foreign policy end as opposed to a personal end. And I think Nick is right that in some ways it's surprising that the president hasn't already said, no, no, I was doing it, or hasn't said more clearly, hasn't made it central to his strategy. No, no, I was doing this for America, not for me. But that there's still a understanding, an expectation, a duty for the president to notify Congress when he is temporarily or permanently withholding congressionally authorized aid. And you know, I think details like that are what really blur the political and the legal and the kind of, you know, the formalities of the system. He maybe... there people are going after him because of politics, but also congressional prerogatives were violated. But also the president has wide latitude to conduct foreign policy. And all of those pieces come together in like a big, hideous broccoli cheese casserole of impeachment.
Broccoli cheese casserole is delicious.
Nick, you have had so many wrong opinions on this podcast already.
Ritz crackers on top. But what I'm saying is, so we go from a world
in which... That's the most Ohio opinion I've ever heard.
I'll stand by that. We'll go, but we are willing to live in a world where, you know, presidents in living memory, not even in living memory, just in the 21st century, you know, consecutive presidents have committed troops to war without clear, you know, declarations of war. And we're not going to impeach them or make a big stink about that. And then this becomes the moment where Congress finds a spine.
Nick, on this podcast is saying none of those other presidents should be impeached or that conduct was awesome and good.
But this question is still a separate one. What I'm saying is that this, Matt, you asked about, like, you know, it's a political process. How do you get principle out of political process? I would submit that this isn't going to help that. And in a way, you know, one of the arguments about Trump, against Trump, is that he, you know, he brings people down to his level. And I think that's one of the things that's going on here. And it may be a good thing for Trump to be removed, to be a president who is actually removed via impeachment. But it's, in a way, it's a very Trumpian power move to do that, especially with an election coming on, you have to look at this in the context of a Democratic field that is so crappy that you have people like, you know, ridiculous people still jumping into the race. Like Deval Patrick and Michael Bloomberg and things like that, there is a panic among Democrats that they will not be able to beat Trump in a general election. And that feeds into this, and it fed into the way the Russia investigation was handled and all sorts of other things that become, you know, vast conspiratorial stories and investigations into the president and the executive branch, you know, that were simply permitted or kind of glossed over even 4 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
But Peter, so I think there's actually an argument to be made here that this is somewhat different than the other instances of bad uses, even abuses of executive power that we have brought up here. And the difference is that in the case of, say, a president taking the nation to war or something like war without clear congressional approval, Congress has an obvious remedy, which is that Congress can pass a resolution saying you can't do that. And in rare instances, Congress has done something like that, but most of the time they don't. And so what they're doing is giving tacit approval. But in either way, they have a potential remedy. And so a Congress that is not going to step in and first say, we're going to pass a resolution.
So why don't they censure him?
Hold on. That says that you can't, is also not going to take the further step of just jumping to impeachment. But in this case, as with Clinton's perjury, it's not clear what Congress has in terms of remedy except the impeachment process. That is the constitutional process that is laid out for Congress to check the executive branch in a case like this, because they don't have an obvious remedy. They can't just sort of go pass resolutions.
That's not true. They can censure him. They can also, and the fact is that when this came to light, the aid was released. So it isn't as if Trump is still holding up the aid or anything like that. So if the issue is the aid, you know, that's been settled by bringing it to the public view and a discussion of things. And it beggars my imagination that this is where we will remove a president over an issue like this after letting all different things slide. And I'm less interested about Trump, but in the future, I know that I think Peter and Catherine and Matt, I don't know where you are on this, you know, are of the opinion that we should impeach presidents more often and things like that. I actually don't think that is the case. I don't think Clinton should have been impeached. I don't really think that Trump should be impeached. I think there should be an airing of this kind of stuff. But it's, you know, you set a precedent when you start to say, okay, we're going for, like, you know, the ultimate nullifier here, to use an old Marvel Universe, illusion. But every time we disagree with something that the president is doing, I think that's a bad way to run government, and it's not going to depoliticize things.
This isn't disagreement. It is disagreement. But it's more than that. It is, I think, the best case, in some ways, the best argument for Trump is the one that you just made, which is that this was a failed attempt to subvert the Constitution. But that's not much of an argument for keeping a president in place, or at least for not. It's not much of an argument for not going through with an impeachment process.
I think the best argument in some ways is the least principled argument, by which I mean the following, and I'm talking about an argument that I'm making. I'm not accusing other people of doing it, which is that to do this 12 months out of an election, or it's going to be sooner than that, seems like not the best remedy to deal with an erratic, power-abusing president, that a better remedy would be voters to say, yeah, you know what, we really don't like this, which they have in kind of proxy ways been saying this pretty consistently over the last couple of years, and also in the general approval ratings of the president and in the public opinion having to do with impeachment so far. They have been doing that. And so it would be a more accepted, actually, sort of like it'd be easier to take that pill. However, then you get into the principle. Are you just going to forego principle of what Congress should do on a given point just because it's a year before the election? And that's where it becomes, I think, a more difficult thing.
So, I mean, I also think this is, you know, in some ways, the underlying question there then is like, well, how important is a year? Right? I mean, you can either say, oh, you know, it's a year, and really, by the time you finish it up, it's like 10 months, and, you know, maybe it's, but also a whole year of a person who may have violated the rules of the presidency being president is a long time. And, you know, I think, you know, a year is eternity when you're 22, and a year is no time at all when you're however old Donald Trump is.
Thank you for not saying.
Or me.
Us.
There's, yeah. Or however old I am. But I mean, I do think that's part of the question here is, in Washington, people have increasingly resigned themselves to the fact that you don't do anything at all in an election year. And like, maybe actually you can't really do anything in the year before the election year. And also, you know, the off year elections, maybe you can't really get anything
done.
You
got about 8 months after a presidential election.
Very wee little amount of time for the actual doing of things. And so to sort of say, we're forfeiting even that amount of time either to the impeachment process, or we're going to skip the impeachment process and just let the presidency play itself out. That's the question that I struggle with. Like, I can't decide how important it is to have a year that we just kind of filibuster and wait to see what happens with the electorate.
Let's, before we exhaust this topic, because it's going to be with us for a while, do a lightning round. If anyone has to the top of their heads any Democratic or Republican highlights or lowlights, I presume most of it's going to be low, but I'll start with Suderman.
I want to know the backstory behind where Jim Jordan's jacket went. Like, what happened? I want somebody to send a reporter, not from Reason Magazine, but someone to send a reporter to like all of the dry cleaners maybe that he uses to, that's really all I've got. I'm fascinated by Jim Jordan's lack of, like consistent lack of jacket.
Nick, you're in favor of jacketless sartorial diversity here.
You know, Jim Jordan is one of the weird winners of this because he is acting in such a slavishly devoted way to defending Trump that people are not talking about his possible involvement in covering up rampant sexual abuse at Ohio State in their athletic department. So he wins from the focus on impeachment and his fecklessness. I think, you know, what I'm going to be looking forward to, and in a way, you know, I'm mixed about this, but this is going to get so much worse as it approaches, you know, the actual writing up of the articles of impeachment and then the actual trial, because it is going to become more and more nakedly political on both sides. And, you know, obviously Congress is political, impeachment is political, the president is political, but it's not a good thing.
And the way that Jim Jordan reads that one sentence over and over again, as fast as he can, is political. Catherine, what was a big highlight, low light of politician behavior?
This is actually a highlight, low light of legal profession behavior, but I'm going to sneak it in here, which is the Stephen Calabresi Sixth Amendment.
Yeah, this is what I was talking about.
Yeah. Like, I think that is the thing that caught my eye and is going to continue to matter. Like, this question of whether it's a criminal proceeding, whether we can take guidelines from criminal proceedings to understand how impeachment proceedings should go forward. And as Nick said, the sort of Trump derangement syndrome, although I hate that term, slash kind of increasing political polarization of our understanding of the Constitution, even by people who already have really well-established views on their understandings of the Constitution.
Amen. Okay. Well, we're going to turn our attention over to the Democrats in a second. But first...
Right.
I just this is all it's not just an audience of one.
Don't make me Doug theme song you.
It's not just an audience of one, but it's a total homage to Monday Night Football highlights in the 1970s and 80s, and I don't even need to explain myself to Nick Gillespie. But then, more from our episode sponsor, Freedom Fest. This is the biggest Liberty Convention of the year, July 13th to 16th. We, on this podcast, have been going there for like at least a decade throughout its full run. Do yourself a favor and go do a YouTube search on Freedom Fest and the huge Trump debate. Just go do that now and then come back to the podcast. You'll be sorry that you did. We always put together a big Reason Day of panel discussions, plus a big song and dance from the main stage. Bob Poole, the sainted Bob Poole, co-founder of the Reason Foundation, has called Freedom Fest, quote, the most intense, rewarding, intellectual, create-your-own conference I've ever attended. This year, the theme is Catch the Vision, which I'm pretty sure is a Rush lyric. Nick, I think I need your backup on
that.
Wow. They've got the Anthem Film Festival, speaking of Rush, which is the biggest juried libertarian film gathering in the world. As far as I know, there's a pitch tank. There's a mock trial on drug legalization. You can see random sightings of Rand Paul and Steve Forbes and John Mackey. And it's at the Paris Las Vegas, which is totally awesome. Visit www.freedomfest.com for all the details and register today for the early bird rates. And as someone who's getting on in years, the phrase early bird means a lot to me. Okay. Nick, you had sort of dropped a mention there of Los Democrats and the field out there and how it's getting ridiculous. So I want to start with you. There's kind of a hot nougaty center of centristy Democrat shush news over the last 5 days. The former president Barack Hussein Obama said at a gathering on Friday, basically for the woke Twitter Democratic Nation to get over themselves and to realize that they're potentially, and I'm putting words in his mouth, but that they're turning off voters, that the world isn't necessarily ready for radical overhauls. You had new polls out from Iowa showing Mayor Pete Buttigieg surging in the corn state. Joe Biden, the previous former centrist in chief, is getting a lot of grief, righteously so and rightfully so, by saying that, I don't know, pot, that's kind of a gateway drug. Bring it all the way back to 1996. Deval Patrick, for some reason, is in the race, a kind of Obama light, centristy, feel good time former Massachusetts governor. And Michael Bloomberg is walking around on an apology tour now for stop and frisk. Suddenly, he's decided that that's a bad idea. It feels like it's all kind of a there's some weird battle for the center or worry about the center. So, Nick, what is your global take on the state of the race and what this kind of panic is indicating to you?
Well, as I was saying before, I think it's that the Democrats realized, you know, everybody understands when you look, Trump, won the presidency with like 46% of the popular vote. Maximum he's going to get anywhere is like 48%. So, you know, he has got to be the easiest candidate to beat. In presidential history, his terrible approval ratings, all of this kind of stuff that the Democrats are so worried about beating him, I think is an indication that it's a party that is going through a real kind of redefinition, just as the Republicans were doing with Trump and will do the minute that he's gone, whether it's, you know, in 4 years or, you know, whatever, after getting reelected or getting cashiered in 2020. You know, the Iowa stuff shows that Biden is being considered too conservative among Iowa voters. Warren is considered too liberal. Pete Buttigieg, who I think is one of the great fake presidential candidates in that people are projecting onto him a bunch of attributes which are not necessarily found in his policy prescriptions. He seems to me to be, very much in a big government liberal category. So, you know, I think what we're seeing here is the fact that the Democrats recognize they can always lose easily winnable elections, and they're kind of shitting their pants about that.
Catherine, you're the Mayor Pete stan here, or the Chasten stan
It's an important distinction
on the podcast. Part of Nick's critique strikes me as both a valid critique of Mayor Pete, but also perhaps an unwittingly valid point in favor of him, which is to say that to be a successful candidate, oftentimes, as Virginia Postrel wrote in our pages about Obama back in the day, that people can project their fantasies on you and you can kind of be whatever you want and that no one's really going to pay close attention. Is that part of your crush on Chasten?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the idea that people are still able to project their hopes and dreams onto even candidates who have brutally detailed bad records is a testament to people's desire to do that. I mean, you know, Michael Bloomberg is out there apologizing for like many decades of Me Too's and also like all of stop and frisk. And he's still like, but don't I seem like the centrist America needs? And people are like, maybe. I mean, mostly no in Bloomberg's case. But with Buttigieg, it's a lot more plausible. And I have to think, though, that the success of the Buttigieg campaign, to the extent that it is successful, has driven all of these New York mayors just up the wall. Like the idea that a mayor of South Bend might win the presidency when there are all these perfectly good mayors of New York City who could do the job, too, is a real testament to the darkness in the heart of New Yorkers, among other things.
Suderman, you live in Washington. Where is and Washington's a totally Democratic town. Admit it.
You got us, Matt. You win. We were going to try and
unlike,
hide that fact.
Unlike New York, right?
New York's the real America here. At least Brooklyn is. I don't know where.
New York is why they hate us, right? It's not DC and it's not the Midwest. I mean, New York is why they hate us.
Decadent enclaves.
Ergo, it is the defining, you know, attribute of America. Ted Cruz hates New York and New York City values. And so does radical Islam.
Peter, what do you take from the fact that we might have touched on this last time that this came through, but like Joe Biden still gets 30% in all polls, except for the polls in Iowa, which, you know, it's not nothing. But like this terror that the center is not holding. And so it needs more centrists.
Well, Joe Biden gets 30% in the polls because his name is Joe Biden. And name recognition continues to be the most important factor, especially when you are, as we are, several months from voting. And just and most voters just don't start really tuning in. They do in Iowa. And that's why I think there's actually some value, like some importance to the Buttigieg surge there, is that, in fact, according to Steve Kornacki, who is always a font of wisdom on sort of on polling and history, you know, election history, since 1976, 7 of the 9 Iowa Democratic winners have gone on to win the nomination. And so it's actually a pretty important metric in a place where people are paying attention already. And Biden's hold shows you that the rest of the field has not truly broken out, Warren more than others. But the rest of the Democratic field hasn't managed to make an impact on Democratic voters. And the people who aren't paying attention, they've heard of Joe Biden. They basically like him. If they are paying attention, that probably means they're a little bit more to the left. They're probably a little more progressive. And that portion of the Democratic base is interested in Elizabeth Warren right now. She has probably run the most competent, most solid campaign. I think there have been some mistakes, but basically she has just sort of come up with a plan and stuck to it.
She has a plan.
Yes, she has a plan to win the nomination. And you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, one thing, I am not a fan of Elizabeth Warren. I think everybody here knows that. I have written many, many words about why I'm not a fan of her or her policies. But her campaign has made clear that she is pretty tactically smart and able to execute without a whole lot of error.
Except when she went for Medicare for All explanations, and that's kind of when her polling topped out.
And in fact,
right?
the Medicare for All stuff is an interesting example of a place where she painted herself into a corner by trying to appeal to the leftward part of the base that she thought she had to win, that she thought she was going to have. She thought she had to be basically with Bernie, in her words, in order to win the Bernie Sanders contingent, which was going to be crucial for her to consolidate enough of the left part, the progressive part of the Democratic primary vote in order to win the nomination. That was correct up front, but it just turned out to be much harder than she thought, than she was aware of, to make a Medicare for All argument work while also running on I am the competent technocrat, because making Medicare for All work as a competent technocrat is not something that you can easily do, and arguably something that really cannot be done, which is why last week, and we don't need to talk about this at length, but last week she released yet another plan for this in which she said, look, I'm splitting up my Medicare for All plan and I'm actually going to go for it for a full 3 years. We're going to start with a different plan. And you see some of the kind of the Bernie vote that has always been a little bit skeptical of her, saying, well, this just shows she's not really serious about Medicare for All, because if you do it in year three, if that's your plan, this goes back to what Catherine was talking about how little time there is to govern. If your plan is to do it in year three, the argument goes, your plan is to not do it at all. And so she has yet again kind of stepped in, right? She's like walking through the rodents of unusual size space, and instead of like being moving around
into the fire pits,
yeah, she just keeps like thwacking them when it comes to the Medicare for All portion.
But Peter, I thought that the Bernie bros didn't like Elizabeth Warren because they were sexist.
Well,
that may well also be the case. Yeah.
I was wondering, actually, this weekend when we had the Obama, you know, kind of tisking at his party about, you know, how people shouldn't be trying to tear down the system and be so lefty radical. Was he subtweeting Elizabeth Warren there? Was he trying to shore her up for her pragmatic stuff? Was he just
it's a total piss take on Bernie and Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
And I think it's a coded
But there's
embrace,
a difference if he's going after
for Joe Biden.
I think, yeah. I mean, there's a difference between going after Bernie and going after Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. And that, like, reading between the lines there was a little bit unclear to me. But yes, I suppose
it's also important to recognize
obligatory
that Obama
Biden backing.
Obama was a disaster for the Democratic Party legislatively. I mean, they lost tons of elected offices during his reign. And in a way, I mean, people should be like, what does he have to add to anything? He's correct in, you know, kind of holding the messages or passing the message that polls consistently show that a majority of Democrats want a party that is less liberal, you know, than it is now and the way that it seems to be headed. But Obama should have very little standing to tell the Democratic Party what, you know, they want.
Once again,
winning re-election, you know, he was a disaster for the party as a party.
The example of Obamacare itself is instructive. You know, President Obama ran, campaigned as a centrist who could sort of at least listen to concerns from both sides and from kind of moderate Republicans. And then he comes in the first major piece of legislation after the stimulus is Obamacare, is the Affordable Care Act, which was viewed at the time as really a radical piece of healthcare legislation. And in fact, with one of the things they did that was somewhat strategically smart, but also has had long-term kind of backfiring ripple effects, is that they dangled the idea of a public option, a government-run health insurance plan to be part of this, and then pulled it off the table. And that was part of how they kept some industry support for this. Anyway, it proved to be much harder to pass than they thought it was going to be. It was a party line vote, all Democrats, right? There was no Republican support for it in the final votes that actually mattered. And then there is very good political science research that shows that Democrats lost the House in 2010 mm-hmm. because they stuck with it after the Scott Brown stuff in Massachusetts. They stuck with it and actually passed the thing. And that it was the Affordable Care Act alone. Maybe there are it's not the only factor, but it is enough of a factor that it could completely explain the flip of the House in 2010 to Republicans.
I also think, I mean, the Affordable Care Act, if the Democratic Party continues on its leftward trajectory, the Affordable Care Act will be Obama's equivalent of what Don't Ask, Don't Tell was for Clinton. Like, it's a half measure that will age badly in a more radical time. People will look down on the compromise.
Well, if you remember the first couple of debates, there was almost no praise of the Affordable Care Act and no praise of Obama's healthcare legacy. And look,
but it depends on who wins, right? I mean, if we wind up with a Biden presidency and correct. Kind of slide through with something that still basically looks like Obamacare, I don't think that narrative will stick.
So even Biden at first was saying, well, let's build an Obamacare. Let's stick with what's already working. And there's an argument for this as a political message and the way it tests. And that's roughly what Democrats did in 2018. But Biden's plan is to spend $750 billion. That is a lot of money. Even like, yes, Medicare for All costs $20 or $30 or $40 trillion, but still $750 billion is a big legislative package to basically do the stuff that the Affordable Care Act was supposed to do. And like when Biden explains the goals of his healthcare plan, it's almost exactly the same stuff that Obama said he wanted the Affordable Care Act to do in the first place.
The Obama legacy, which has not gotten enough attention, partly because Trump is so polarizing and people are like, oh, you know, Trump is the worst. Obama, with the Affordable Care Act, with the stimulus, which started, in TARP under Bush, but then Obama enlarged and extended and broadened, he smothered the economy for most of his presidency through regulatory actions, as well as through massive deficit spending. And, you know, people can say, oh, well, you know, the economy recovered and spending went down from a peak in 2010 slightly. But he ratcheted up and kept spending up in unsustainable ways. And the Democratic Party, I think, the more that they have to start talking about how, oh, well, we're going to spend $750 billion for Joe Biden. Pete Buttigieg has a $1 trillion plan for jobs and, you know, child care and everything else that ails you. Every candidate, even the centrist ones, just want to jack up government spending. And the more that they have to talk about that, I think that's going to actually temper interest in what they're talking about or enthusiasm for that among most Americans who are not so short-memoried that they don't remember when government expands everything. You know, it has negative effects on everyday life and the overall economy.
Speaking of negative effects or potential negative effects that might have been avoided, sidestepped, we just have news out from this morning and yesterday that President Trump appears to have backed away from planned crackdown on flavored vapes. Elizabeth Nolan Brown wrote about it on our website this morning. We don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but Catherine, I want you to do a victory dance with your throat.
I won't, but also, I mean, this is the upside of Donald Trump's lack of ideological commitments, and it's not an upside in the end, I think, is worth it. But if you govern entirely based on some combination of whim and a desire for personal gain and revenge and electoral pressures, then sometimes you get stuff like this, which is that when you do something genuinely unpopular, that the vast bureaucracy of the state has been shoving itself toward for years and years, you will be perfectly happy to reverse those types of decisions on a dime without really consulting anyone. And sometimes those reversals are good because they were bad decisions. And sometimes those reversals were bad because they are good decisions. In this case, yay, now we can all have Mango Jewel again.
It's also like what presidential candidate or even leading politician is actually in favor of, flavor freedom for vaping. So this is a win.
I presume Andrew Yang, but maybe I'm wrong about that. He just
Andrew Yang has put forward a secretary of media attention or something like that, where he wants to regulate social media because it's so harmful to kids and they're monetizing our private data, et cetera. Like Andrew Yang is not a hands off.
Matt just assumed he seems like kind of a vapey bro.
He seems more like a vape bro. He's a statist, but he's a vape bro. I will point out that the aforementioned Michael Bloomberg has responded on Trump's walk back by saying, "If President Trump won't take steps to protect our children, then we need someone in the office who will." So if you needed another reason to not ever think about voting for Michael Bloomberg, there it is.
Does anybody here though think let's assume fantasy happens and Michael Bloomberg either becomes the Democratic nominee or actually becomes president? Would he be worse than any of the other Democratic contenders?
Possibly,
because he at least understands capitalism in a profound way.
You could say the same thing about Trump.
You could say the same thing, but
actually, I don't know that you can, because Trump is a fake businessman. Michael Bloomberg has he became a billionaire by providing a service that is continuing to grow and be valuable and has shifted over time. And he also, when he governed New York, complete idiot on a lot of nanny state stuff and not just the soda cup stuff or salt bans and smoking bans and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, the stop and frisk stuff was terrible. It's great that he's apologizing for it, but it's kind of, a little bit too little too late. But New York prospered under him in a significant way. And if you talk to any business person in New York, whatever their political inclinations and commitments, they'll be like, he was pretty good for the business sector in New York, which is kind of what you want in a president.
Yeah, I don't want a president who has a cavalier approach to the Constitution.
That's not my question.
No, your question was whether he be any worse than anybody else. Yeah. And he's really, really bad on fundamental constitutional questions. And that is kind of a non-starter for me, which makes most.
So would he be worse than which is Kamala Harris better or, Pete Buttigieg or that's what I'm saying, because this is all relative, right? And it's all comparative question.
Yeah,
I don't see it better here.
I don't see a necessarily a worse, but someone who's in charge of a regulatory state, which the administrative state is, who is so absolutely committed to regulation. The only person who comes close, I think, to his sense of regulation is and knowledge of it is Elizabeth Warren. And I think that's a terrifying idea to have as someone who sits atop the regulatory bureaucracy of being such an enthusiastic regulator. I don't think it's a good idea, regardless of how much better he understands capitalism than Donald Trump or than Bernie Sanders, certainly. But since you asked the question, before we get to the end of a show, cultural consumption, Nick, please.
I think we've got another.
There you go.
Was that a Wookiee?
It was a Wookiee playing a trumpet. It was,
Oddly, it was a Wookiee playing a banjo. But
this
is our message delivered.
Final ad from our friends at Freedom Fest. And Wookiee playing a banjo is a pretty good setup for this, because I think we've all witnessed some pretty amazing.
A Wookiee playing a banjo?
I witnessed and sang with Grover Norquist in tights at Freedom Fest, is what I'm telling you people. There have been whiskey thons
with Thomas Massey, the Stream of Consciousness rants.
Were people wearing tights during that too?
It's to be assumed. Donald Trump.
You know,
rants.
This is going to Freedom Fest is like Roy Batty out on the edges of the universe. You're going to see things that will blow your mind.
Yes, that can't be unseen. Various unspeakable activities in hotel rooms and whatnot. The bottom line is freedom, Catherine. Freedom, as in www.freedomfest, which is where y'all should head right now to lock in your rate, Chuckle Pants Suderman. I have met so many people over the years who have actually thanked us for running Freedom Fest ads in the magazine. It was a big decision on our part to accept money. I found out about Freedom Fest through reading a Reason magazine ad, and so glad that I did. So that's your pitch right there. Go check it out. Okay. You people have been consuming. Nick, you've been consuming, speaking of unspeakable behavior. What did you do this weekend?
I started watching the final season of Man in the High Castle,
oh,
which I'm excited about. But mostly what I spent this weekend doing an ayahuasca journey. And it was fantastic. It was spectacular. I didn't see the jaguar, but I did see a lot of things that I'll be processing for a long time to come. I highly recommend. My experience was completely positive, and I followed it up with, after ayahuasca, with Wachuma, which is the kind of mescaline day that you do after ayahuasca. And it was a fantastic journey to the edges, to the center of my mind, I suppose. You know, your results may vary, but it was a really, really fascinating kind of journey.
I look so forward
that's
to
what I was doing.
The Reason interview with Nick Gillespie being performed on ayahuasca at some point.
Matt, I am tripping balls right now. So
can I go next for a contrast?
Yes.
I, this weekend, read Dreyer's English, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style. I read a book about copy editing this weekend while
wow.
Nick was on an ayahuasca trip. So that's what I have to say. This is meant to be a
You're a really exciting person.
I'm awesome. It's meant to be a competitor to Strunk and White, a new kind of skinny style guide to go along with all the rules to help you think about how to be a better and clearer writer. It was actually extremely good. The one thing that I would potentially quibble about with this book is that the book very accurately describes the process of copy editing, which includes a lot of, honestly, this is the rule, but sometimes you shouldn't follow the rule because it just looks too crazy and you should just do what you want to do, which is how it is to be a copy editor, but might not be helpful to a layman trying to learn how to write. Anyway.
So the rules are right, except when you should just ignore them.
Yeah, which
it
is true about
like
a lot of things
in
life.
It sounds like you have been taking ayahuasca, where
I do.
It's both a ritual ceremony
a
and then you exceed it with your own personal
a rebellious
journey
into the dark heart of copy editing.
Not the dark heart.
It was good,
the
though,
beautiful
guys.
Heart.
It's by Benjamin Dreyer, and I recommend it.
I took the Peter Suderman recommendation, which I already feel bad about, of seeing Parasite, the South Korean heavy metaphor movie.
It's so heavy with metaphor that the characters are constantly joking to each other that something seems metaphorical.
Yeah, this sure is metaphorical. And because I go on like date movie nights with my wife about once a decade, these are precious commodities for us. And in fairness, The Irishman was sold out. But it was, you know what? I think that there's a line in my movie going experience. And that line happened with having children. And like on one side of the line, there's like, wow, Trainspotting is the most awesome movie ever. And the other side of line of that is I would never willingly see that movie again. There's no way in hell. And Parasite is kind of on.
Why? Why? The kids work out well in Trainspotting, Matt, if I'm remembering correctly.
What about the sequel to Trainspotting?
Nope. Yeah. Didn't see. Oh, for the sequel to Trainspotting
is
Slumdog
real?
Millionaire.
Is there a real
that
thing?
Wasn't any good either. So.
What?
I said it. Enough exploding toilets. I don't need them. Enough.
Slumdog is not a great movie. It's true.
It's hard out here. I've taken to even seeing movies without kids.
I'm looking at Common Sense Media to see whether it's going to be too violent for me.
You just want to know like how much strong language and interpersonal violence there is
and
before you go.
Also consumerism. They're like, you know, it's pretty consumerist. But it's still a very interesting movie, thought-provoking. I don't want to rescind Peter's recommendation. It is sticking with me a little bit longer than I expected, so that must have done...
Like a parasite.
Like a parasite. Yep, Peter.
Is it a lamprey on your mind, Matt Welch?
It's more like a leech on the old nether regions. Peter, what did you...
wow.
What did you consume this weekend?
What a... That's
I
like
watched The Irishman, but I'm not
going
to talk about that until next week. I've been reading the Ben Lerner novel, The Topeka School, which came out this year. It is a kind of quasi-autobiographical novel about a lot of things, but in most... Like the thing it is most about is high school debate in the 1990s in Kansas. And so I wasn't in debate. I didn't do the policy aspect of debate, but I did the individual events, kind of the acting events, HIDEA, humorous interpretation, dramatic interpretation. So you would act out a sort of a humorous or dramatic play entirely by yourself. But I hung out with and traveled with the debate teams and am sort of familiar with that milieu. And this novel is just a kind of fascinating literary and cultural trip for me in particular, because Lerner is about my age. He's like 2 years older than I am. And you know, the Midwest and the South, you know, the debate teams are the cultures are a little different, but not that much. He's writing about being a kind of a liberal-ish kid whose parents were both psychologists, one of whom is in the book a famous feminist author, and then his father specializes in troubled boys who have anger issues. And so the book is about the ways that language and culture and time and politics all sort of kind of come together in and like form this weird psychological stew of teenage male angst. And so it's also like, I mean, it's really a kind of there's a great sort of journey through American politics, because most of it is in the 1990s, but there's also a little bit of reflection from right now. So Donald Trump's name gets dropped just once in the book, but he kind of looms over its proceedings. And he just does he's a poet and he's known for his poetry, but he also has occasionally written novels. And he just does such a great job of capturing the way that, especially as you get a little bit older, you're both living in the moment you're living in, but also kind of constantly living in moments of the past. And so he's got all of these passages and chapters in which people are just sort of like kind of swimming in their memories and you know, as the memories and the moment they are in swirl around them and all become kind of the same thing. And so it's like it's really a great book, and it's a great follow-up actually to the previous novel that I'd read, Fleischman is in Trouble, because in the way that that one was very much about kind of middle-aged gender differences, and in particular about the ways that you know, sort of 40-ish men and women relate to these days, this book is much more of a kind of focus on male psychology and male and the way that men relate to the world.
Oh, yay. Yes. A literary novel about male psychology. But that will be fun. Are there father issues in it?
But written by two New Yorkers who are about the same age.
I'm being a jerk. Yes. I shouldn't yuck your yum.
And there's also
yum.
Chapters from the mother's perspective. They make for an interesting contrast. And so I would recommend it to people who like good sentences.
I'm glad that we all played into all of our stereotypes with gusto.
Pretty hard.
This time.
Pretty hard.
Hey, guys, gals, quick programming note here. In 2 weeks, we are doing our annual Reason Webathon, in which we ask consumers of Reason's products for tax-deductible end-of-the-year donations. I'm not asking you for those right now. It'll come up. What I am asking is that you send the Reason Roundtable your questions. These could be about impeachment or Medicare for all prices or cocktail recipes or buying leather jackets, whatever. The point is, we will answer those questions on video. It'll be a special Ask Us Anything video presentation of the Reason Roundtable during the webathon. So send your question or questions to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. Ask us as a group or individually, and we'll hopefully get to them all in an upcoming webathon video. And other than that, just a reminder to subscribe to our other two main podcasts, which are the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum debates. Just go to reason.com/podcasts and do your thing.
And if I may, please. Matt, we've got a great interview with Dan Carlin of Hardcore History coming up on Wednesday on the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. So if you're a fan of Hardcore History or of podcasts in general, that's one that you'll want to subscribe for to get delivered directly to your listening device.
Awesome. Thank you, everyone. See you next week.